I'm starting this episode with the sounds from a video of pure bliss. The sun is setting, a wooden boat has peacefully punted down a water channel with a very contented looking dog enjoying the light breeze ruffling his white fur. For anyone passing, this may just look like a single sweet moment, a man enjoying some downtime with his dog. But this moment is about so much more than that. It's about possibility, an experiment, seeing a chance at a different kind of future and trying it on for size. Before I arrived in Nairobi, I was told by Christine Mungai, a Nairobi-based writer and major podcast enthusiast, that she's seen a trend since the COVID pandemic began of more and more people talking about or even acting on a desire to move out from the capital city back to a more simple life in the countryside. We've seen similar stories across the world as lockdowns prompted people and companies to find effective ways to keep up work remotely. The tantalizing possibility of a life far away from the office has sparked imaginations. But when I started following Christine's leads to investigate this trend, what started as an exploration of changing preferences and possibilities, and people defying the much-cited African trend for urbanization, led me down a path of fascinating conversations about changing city spaces, lives exhausted by a never-ending hustle, and fundamental questions about what constitutes a happy and successful life. So I'm excited to share with you two stories of individuals at different points of what some are calling the Great Migration. One man and his dog currently trying out a new life in the countryside before deciding whether to do it for real. And a family of five who've already taken the plunge and are 5 years into building their dream home in the green hills of Kitanga. I'm Kim Chakaneta and this is The Comb, a BBC World Service original podcast.
This is The Comb.
Ye ni The Comb.
The Comb, no.
Ni The Comb.
The Comb.
So let's start with that video of man, dog, boat and sunset. I'm not there, unfortunately. I've just fought my way through the rush hour traffic to get to a BBC studio in Nairobi. But here I'm going to speak down the line to the guy who is. Mugambi Nthiga is a filmmaker, writer, actor and director, usually based in Nairobi, but speaking to me today from Malindi on the coast, where he's experimenting with a different way of life.
So I took a bit of my savings and decided for the month of March that I was going to give myself the experience of not living in Nairobi as a way of softening my brain up to the possibility of moving outside of Nairobi. So I booked out a bunch of Airbnbs, and me and my dog, his name is Superfly,
came down.
Yes, we came down to the coast.
We'll get to Mugambi's try-out life in Malindi in a moment. But first, I want to understand more about what he's considering leaving behind. Have you always lived in Nairobi?
I am. I'm Nairobi born and raised. I'm 41 years old and I've lived there pretty much all my life.
What did you like about life in Nairobi during your childhood?
Oh, it wasn't boring. It was interesting. There was always something to do. There was always people to meet. In the early 90s, there was a lot of, liberalization of technology, of communication. We're watching all this cool stuff and music started to blow up. And somehow the 90s gave birth to this very fresh expression of culture and independence and self, and we found a new voice. So there was something about the vibe of living in Nairobi that was just so hypnotizing.
Growing up in Nairobi, what was the community around you like?
Oh, wow. I remember a Nairobi that's significantly different from the Nairobi we have now. There was a sense of community, but by the 90s, Nairobi became particularly more dangerous for a whole bunch of reasons.
What do you remember of that specifically?
Well, where do I start? I don't know if you've heard of, in local parlance, like it's a nickname that we have for Nairobi, being Nairobari. This is something that came up in the late 90s or the early 2000s when Nairobi became increasingly more insecure. The stakes start to rise when more and more people are coming into the city because there's so much rural-urban migration happening and the spaces become smaller and smaller and the faces are becoming stranger and stranger. And soon, when you have a lot of people that can't find work or are poor or are feeling disenfranchised, they might turn to petty crime. With the downturn of the economy in the early 90s, the shilling got devalued. We wake up to prices of commodities going up and the price of living just shot up, and suddenly Nairobi was a very difficult place to live in. And naturally, crime went from petty to, you know, it started becoming more violent. I remember the first time our house got broken into, I think it was 8 or 9. And it was the first time, you know, they broke into the house. They cut off our telephone line so we couldn't call the police. But this was happening all over the place.
Faced with these scary new threats, people responded in the way that seemed to make sense.
People started building walls and they started building metal gates that you couldn't see through. And they'd do this thing where they'd put cement on the top and break bottles and pieces of glass. So now I remember seeing those growing up, but there weren't anywhere as many.
Of course, while security can be stepped up fairly easily, it's psychologically very difficult to step it down again. And as increased security became the norm, the city changed.
You look back and you're like, oh man, I could see that happening. And we substituted yards for parking lots, and then we substituted grass for either like maram or tarmac, which we played on. They would come now and build a wall, and the wall established two things: one, security, and two, privacy. There was this feeling that if the man of the house wasn't home, that the house was exposed. So you didn't want people to know if the man of the house was there or not. And so we substituted a gate that you could see through to a gate that now that you couldn't see through at all. Somehow, slowly by slowly, we were cloistering ourselves away from each other. And now in retrospect, of course, if you have a physical barrier between people, then a psychological barrier builds as well.
For Mugambi, this has gone hand in hand with a sense of losing access to the most basic of communal resources.
There has been such a reduction of green spaces. Any space that I want to go and feel safe has to be enclosed behind a gate and separated from me by money or relationships. I have to know people. For me to sit under a tree that is not in my neighborhood, I have to go to a place where I have access, where a watchman won't ask, what are you here for? What are you doing? Or where I won't have to pay a parking fee so that I can sit in a restaurant and not be disturbed and not get frisked at the door with a wand and not sign a book or leave my ID. Pretty much every space right now has to have a cost attached to it, whether it's in time, whether it's in money, or whether it's in relationship or resource. And that's not the city I grew up in.
Unease about this reality has been growing among many Nairobians for years, even decades. But it seems like the past few years, dominated by the coronavirus pandemic, have provided a particular moment in time where a different way of life seems both possible and desirable.
I, just like everyone else, came face to face with the fact that we might all die. And this is it. And the best of life as we knew it is done. So with this, you know, clear and very present prospect that life as you knew it had come to an end, I and a bunch of people I know, we made decisions as to how our life was going to go. And one of the decisions I made was I was intentionally going to just slow down and struggle less.
Like millions of us, Mugambi had to develop new ways to work remotely during COVID restrictions. And he found it allowed him a different pace of life, which felt healthier than how things had been before. So he started to wonder, why stay in Nairobi if you can work from anywhere? And why not make the change permanent?
Now, the interesting thing is when I shared this idea to some friends, thinking that it was very novel, they said, oh, so you're part of the immigration of Nairobi filmmakers to Kilifi. And I said, wait, what? There's other people doing that?
You're not unique, Mugambi.
Not at all. Yeah, my bubble got burst. A lot of us feel this way. I don't know how many of us actually talk about it.
The coast, with its boats and beach bars, you can see the appeal.
Everything runs a little bit slower. The cost of living is not that much cheaper, but it is. You do feel a bit of the ease. And it's just slower. I'm having a lot more human interactions. If I walked up to anyone in Nairobi and started like, and went, excuse me, out in the streets, there immediately would be a bracing of like, okay, what are we getting ready for here? Because you don't really know what to expect when someone comes up to you and says hello. There's a lot less of that here. And I'm feeling a little bit more like myself. I sent pictures to my siblings and my folks in Nairobi. And my siblings are like, hey, dude, you look very much at peace now. And I'm like, well, rowing on a creek with your dog will do that to you. I've still been trying to get the hours in, any jobs that I have to do, any director's treatments that I have to write, any conversation, necessary conversations, I'll make time for those. But if you understand what I say, when I say I'm chilling, man, I'm existing. I'm doing something I haven't done in a long time and just existing. When was the last time you just existed?
So this sounds to me like it's been wholly positive. Because now, what's been, a week and a half now? So overall, yes. Thumbs up? You're loving it?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
It's easy to start to think that this is a done deal. Mugambi is clearly so content in his new surroundings. But when I push him for thoughts on whether he's ready to actually commit yet, it's a no. That momentous decision still needs work. I'm going to leave Mugambi there with his dilemma for now. Because I want to share with you my visit to a family who already made that choice 5 years ago and are now living up in the hills of Kitanga, about 50 kilometers from Nairobi.
Now, the first thing I've learned about leaving Nairobi is that it's harder to find addresses. We had to make a U-turn just a little while back. And now we're going down this bumpy road. We're going uphill. Hopefully, I'm on our way to find Leslie's house. But it's very clear to me that we've left Nairobi. It's so much quieter. You can just hear birds singing. And it's acres and acres of greenery around me. And it just smells and sounds completely different.
Yes, we got a bit lost. And while we were trying to find our way, talk in the car turned to the topic of this episode. And it quickly became clear that it's not just our contributors who are reassessing things.
Lisa, would you live out?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You'd move out Nairobi?
Yeah.
Why?
Both our camera operator, Isa, and our driver, John, said that moving out was something they'd been contemplating recently as well.
After the pandemic, after COVID, I think it proved to me that it's possible and it's something I can do.
So we finally found Leslie, Richard and their kids.
Oh, is this it? Is this the gate?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, look at this. Just like surrounded by like green and vegetation and trees.
Hello.
Hi. Hello.
Hi.
I'm Kim. Hi. Hi, Leslie.
Hi. How are you?
Very well, Leslie. This is beautiful.
Former Nairobians, Leslie and Richard, along with their three kids, Salim, Mumbe and Noah, have been here creating their new home for the past 5 years.
So we're here, as you say, in Moy Hills, in your beautiful, beautiful home, and we're getting a taste of the life you're living here. but before we talk about, how you got here, let's just talk about life before you moved. When did you start living together in Nairobi?
Well, right after we got married,
okay, right,
we moved into his house.
And what was that like?
I came from my parents' house. So mm-hmm. for me, I was like, yes!
Freedom!
Freedom! So we take walks at night. I'm like, I have no curfew. And walks in the morning. It was nice. It was good.
Mm-hmm. But the freedom of adulthood comes with challenges as well.
I mean, I think your first interaction with life as an adult is when you finish university and now you need to get a job and start paying your own bills or move out. So your choices are limited to either doing an 8-to-5 job that you don't necessarily enjoy, but you have to do it to pay the bills. And that just wasn't me. You know, I just the idea of being in one place for a big part of your day and week. I think there are people who that's just not in their system, you know, and no matter how hard you try. So I could only do it for 3 months.
The 8-to-5 work pattern was never going to suit Richard. He started work instead as a freelance sound recorder, which gave him the freedom to plan his own time. But it also came with anxiety of uncertain work patterns and fear of what happens if that work dries up.
I think just those pressures started to catch up with us when, you know, he doesn't have work. And I, too, struggled with, you know, just that 8-to-5. At the time, I was starting a company with my friends for, you know, childcare. We wanted to do childcare. Mm-hmm. So we were trying to work on that startup. And it was challenging financially to know you have bills to pay. You need to buy food.
And when you're in the city and you're not working, then what are you doing? Mm. You know, you're on the internet, struggling to pay for internet because that's what you do in the city. You need internet in your house, yeah? You need like a TV subscription. Mm-hmm. So you just flip channels all day, right? You know, so when I'm not working, I'm really not doing anything else. And that's kind of like your life wasting away.
With the cost of living rising, Leslie and Richard moved further out from the centre to find cheaper rent. But it wasn't enough to remove the anxiety.
I used to say that every morning you wake up when you're in the city, you better have money in your pocket because basically you're just on someone's expense, yeah? So life has gotten increasingly expensive. You're kind of working for your bills. So the beauty now is that if we go out to work, then you kind of can see where the money goes because you're kind of building into something that you can see. And I always used to feel every 5th of the month like I was just paying rent into like a big black hole because you're just throwing money that you can never get back. Yeah.
And you begin to change, you know, like towards the end of the month,
yeah,
you know, see there's like
where's
a mood
the rent,
change.
You know?
He's not settled, you know, so...
Yeah. You'd be like,
you
my
know.
Time of the month.
Yeah, it was like your time of the month.
No disrespect. She's the one.
So when did you start having the conversation about leaving Nairobi?
So my parents gave us this portion of land.
We had a grand plan, which is what you do when you're in the city. You
Big
know,
house.
you have this grand plan. Well, it was more grand than this.
Yes.
But so we had an architect kind of draw up a plan for us. But
drawing up a plan of a dream house is one thing. Making it a reality is quite another when your money is still disappearing in rent each month. So they came up with a practical way forward.
So I remember we were sitting in the sitting room of our house in Nairobi. So we drew up this house based on our sitting room, dining room and kitchen. We were like, you know what? We can just build something like this. Because right now we know we need to move because things are getting to be a bit too expensive and it's becoming unmanageable. So let's just build something small to kind of just tide us over. Then we can at least then afford to build because then our, you know, whatever income we get, we can pour in there as opposed to it going to rent. So we drew this up.
Yeah.
You know, a rectangle, and we're like, kitchen, sitting room, dining room, sitting room.
That's the space we're sitting in now for this conversation. It's as basic as Leslie says, a rectangle divided into a kitchen at one end, living space in the middle, bedroom and toilet at the end. It's small and simple, but it certainly feels like a home. 5 years ago, when they first moved, even this space wasn't quite so ready. The cement was still drying, there was still painting to do. They stayed for a couple of weeks at Leslie's parents, and that was fine. But other realities about their life change hit a bit harder.
It was hectic. Oh, it was quite hectic. We were happy mm-hmm. and relieved. Like, wow, we are finally in our own space, you know. So there's that happiness, but then there's also my friends are far, you know, what am I going to do? That was something I struggled with.
Yeah.
He was good.
Richard, no issues. You're like, bye, friends. See ya.
Yeah, I'm like, hey, if you're a good friend, then you will come visit me.
And you see how long that journey is.
Yeah, yeah.
Kind of narrows the friend list.
Yeah. So was the social aspect what worried you the most initially, Leslie?
I think so. I mean, we had, you know, like if they do baby showers, mm-hmm. I have to really plan. Before I could just decide, you know what, I want to go for an afternoon and visit somebody for 2 hours and come back. I can't do that now. If I'm going to Nairobi, it's a day.
It's a day trip.
Yeah. So, but I've come to value the silence. I've grown. Yeah.
Yeah. But also, it's like you make new friends.
Yeah.
You know, you create new communities and same even for the children, you know, they've made new friends here.
Mm-hmm. What was your biggest adjustment, Richard? What was the toughest adjustment?
I mean, I think for me was to make this place functional and comfortable for them, I think is my biggest, you know, I'm preoccupied with that, you know. So are we able to use a washing machine? Do we have enough running water in the house, you know? Just to make it feel like home. I think it took us about 3 years to pay off the debts that we had just from friends, from relatives. You know, now we can kind of just start doing our own thing, you know. And for me, it's worth everything, just to be able to not owe anyone any money and still have food on your table.
And of course, there's still that dream home in progress. Step out the door from this small house and you can see it taking real shape just up the slope.
So here is our entrance is just down there a bit. This is the front yard. Mm-hmm. Eventually we want to, I think with the rain season that's coming, we want to plant grass all along here. Do you want, and then we want to put like a bouncing castle over there,
the
you know, just
castle.
Have a nice child-friendly front yard.
Yeah. I mean, the bouncing castle will have the best views in the world.
Yes, absolutely.
Green valley.
Be careful not to bounce too high.
And off.
So this is our entrance.
Okay.
So welcome.
Thank you very much.
To our humble abode.
Yes. I like this door. This is lovely.
Thank you.
All right.
I'll follow you, Christine.
This is the sitting room. And we have a fireplace. I've always wanted a fireplace. So I think we'll do a lot of living here. And Richard wanted big windows because of the natural light.
Yes. So this is a good-sized main family room. So this is where the heart of the family will be.
Yeah, this is where everyone congregates away from their mobile phones and tablets.
Yeah.
We hope, yeah.
To be at one with nature.
Yeah.
I can still see this bags of cement.
Yeah.
Construction is still on the go. Just thinking back of when you were in Nairobi and you were dreaming big dreams of what life
Grand.
Could be like.
Yes.
I wonder, has the reality matched the dream?
I think it has even surpassed it,
Ooh.
But gradually, because, you know, like how he's saying, you know, he's had to kind of figure out how to make this home livable. You know, water was a big issue. Oh. You know, and I haven't ever known anything but running water. As we've made this space our own, you know, as we've planted flowers and we've changed this place out here so many times, you know, just to kind of make it look the way we want it to look. It's like, wow, I didn't even imagine that it could be this awesome. It's always also a blessing to see it through, you know, other people's eyes. Every time, you know, people come and they're like, wow, it's like, yeah, you know, we are so blessed to have this space and this beautiful view, you know, things we can take for granted.
You always think that something can just happen.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether that's one of the lies we have in our age, you know, like just get someone here and let them do everything that's in your mind and then you just walk into it, yeah.
Mm.
And sometimes, even when friends visit, they kind of think that it just happened. But, you know, like we have the story of all the trees that we have planted, you know. Because that's the other thing. When you're in the city, your mind is so closed up to what you can actually do by yourself. So if we would wake up one morning and the water is not running down the sink, the first thing you think immediately is call a plumber. But when you're here and there's no plumber to call, then you open the sink and you're like, oh, that looks like there's a joint I can unlock. So let me do that. And when you open, you're like, it's clogged. You're like, voila. So I think all the times in the city when we call a plumber and he just busied himself for like 20, 30 minutes and then you give him his pay. Mm-hmm. And you're like you lose so much money because I think there's like a certain part of your mind that is not exercised. So it's kind of, yeah, it's kind of like idle. So
also, you know, like we imagined we'd come and plant things in the soil and they would grow. How many failed?
You plant.
You know, there's a science, there's an art, you know, and we've learned through talking with people.
Yeah.
It's been a process.
Yeah. Given all that,
yeah.
Do you miss anything about your old life? At all. Shaking your head, Leslie, straight nope. away. I didn't even finish the question.
Not at all. I think for me, I've always thought success meant financial stability. But that's not necessarily true. I think moving here, and I don't want to say we're not financially stable, but we don't have the, you know, amount of money that I felt we needed in order to live and survive. But we're happy. The kids are happy.
It's not easy. It takes courage to do, and I don't know many people who would do it. You know, it takes courage, and then it takes the work, you know, to plant that flower, plant that tree, or
uproot that tree, move it there.
Yeah, it's all worth it. Mm-hmm.
I'm going to literally have to pack up everything and move this way. I mean, literally uproot myself from a life I've known and start a new one elsewhere. The last time I did this.
Back in Malindi, Mugambi is still trying to weigh up the benefits and consequences of making his move permanent, away from his family and friends in the capital city.
Nairobi can be the best place in the world to live if you have money. Money will get you everything. It'll get you the space. It'll get you the connections, it'll get you the security, it'll get you the experiences. Every single thing that I mentioned in this interview is accessible if you have money. So yeah, if somehow I was able to make a lot of money in Nairobi without giving my soul, yeah, that might be the thing that would make me stay, for sure.
Mugambi has realized that simply moving out of the city can't work on its own. A complete change in mindset is required in order to find the peace he's craving.
I found the biggest compromise for myself is to shut off the monologue that I realized was not my own, that was handed to me. It happens all the way back to the education system where we have to just be working hard, work hard, work hard, always be studying, studying, studying. And, you know, it's all about the grades and there's always this trophy that you're chasing and chasing and chasing. And we're always looking at rest as a few steps down the line and we never stop to actually consider what rest is. I realized I didn't know what rest actually is. So I had to change the internal monologue and trust that I could create a new life for myself where I probably won't be the wealthiest person. I probably won't be living by the manual that has me having to chase, and that I would have to slow down and actually give myself the permission to do so. I think the Nairobian conversation, and believe me, we have been having these conversations with ourselves while we've been holed up at home wondering what the meaning of life is. Is that the dogma of Nairobi is not of our doing, and we have the capability of creating the lives that we want to create by any means necessary.
This episode was produced by Mary Goodhart, Aisha Afra, and me, Kim Chakaneta. Rob Wilson did our sound design. Toby Hilder is our studio manager. Piers Lynch is our editor. And a special thanks to Christine Mungai for her help with this episode.